Hello, I'm Will.
And I'm Leah.
And this episode is going to be different to any of the other ones we've done before because we are not going to be talking. Because there's
things going on in the world right now which we aren't really qualified to discuss. Watching the news this last week of the protests in the wake of the death of George Floyd in police custody, we didn't feel it was appropriate for us either to look away from that and do a normal episode or to, you know, discuss any science news that might relate to police brutality or racism or similar subjects. So as an alternative, we have decided to hand you over to one of our favourite podcasts, Why Aren't You a Doctor Yet?, and their discussion with Angela Desani about her book Superior, which is about the history of race science, and The Gang's Matrix, which was in development in the UK, which raises quite a lot of concerns about racial profiling in policing.
You can find more from the Why Aren't You a Doctor Yet team on Twitter at Why Not a Doc. The podcast is available through Acast and any other podcatcher that you're using. Just search for Why Aren't You a Doctor Yet and you'll find it. So be sure to listen to the whole interview they've got with Angela Desani and then go on to listen to all of the rest of their episodes as well. You can also find some useful resources for educating yourself about the history of oppression and racism in the US, the UK and globally. Are linked in the show notes for this episode. You can find resources for donating to charities in the US, in the UK, and locally as well. There is a fundraiser running for Bristol Black Lives Matter, Changing Your Mindset, which is based out of the Malcolm X Centre just around the corner from our flat. So if you want to donate to anything very local to us, then there is that. But this is a global problem, and there will be people in your neighbourhood, in your country, closer to you, that are definitely going to appreciate any contributions that you can make in terms of your money, time, or attention. We're going to be following on from the release of this episode by sharing more resources through our own social media feeds on Twitter. If there's anything that you would like for us to help direct attention to, anything that we could uplift or promote, then do let us know and we'll do what we can to make sure that those voices are heard.
And thank you very much to Alex, Hannah, Oz, and Suhail for letting us share their episodes this week.
We want to be able to categorize people as good and bad. We want to be able to look at history and say, these are the good people and these are the bad people, these are the racists, these are the anti-racists. And actually, it's not like that. It's more complicated than that. And we have to remember James Watson, while I'm not defending him in any way, and I think actually the Academy and Coltering Harbour were so slow in taking away his honours and fellowships, much too late. We have to remember, like he said, he is more than 90 years old. When he was born, the idea that there was a racial hierarchy was mainstream. Loads of scientists believed it. There were eugenics labs in London, all over the place. There were loads of scientists doing research into human differences and then telling us that certain people were better than others. And this was the pretext for 200 years upon which slavery was allowed, justified, that genocide and colonialism and all these things, it was the edifice upon which everything was built. So how can we expect James Watson, who was born into that and educated into that, to feel any different? And especially, I think there's a certain arrogance that comes with really smart people, especially scientists who think that because they're really good at their science, whatever they think about the rest of the world must also be true, you know? And that they shed their prejudice, I find, much slower than the rest of us because they feel that they have some kind of privileged morality, some privileged access to knowledge that we don't have. So whatever their prejudices are, aren't prejudices at all. They're just facts. And I think he is one of those people. So I think he's a racist, but I also think he's a product of a system. And we are all products of that system. We all carry that subtle bias in a way. We all have these little prejudices. And having to confront that and examine ourselves, I think, is the way to move forward and start to understand how we can deal with this, because condemning individuals is not enough. Not just in science, but in economics. You see these people who have great ideas, Nobel Prize winners, and, you know, another great racist of the 20th century, William Shockley, who's a physicist at Stanford, and he thought that black women in America should be sterilized because they were, you know, through this kind of negative eugenics program, because their babies would just be naturally inferior to white babies. And although he was recognized as a racist because he was so obvious about it, people did listen to him because he was William Shockley. You know, he was this famous Nobel Prize-winning mind. So how can he not be right about everything? But of course, it's perfectly possible to be good at one thing and not know anything about other things.
Right. Yeah. I think it's a logical fallacy, isn't it? It's an argument from authority, and it works in another way because people try to discredit other people's views by saying, "Oh, because of their character," isn't it? One of the things I really found interesting was, and you kind of touched upon it, it's like the systems that they move in place and how this race science, how like ubiquitous it was in the past and how that formed like a large part of history and shaped a lot of political thinking in the past. And like, you know, in the book you talk a lot about World War II and Nazism and how they used kind of race science as a structure to build their racist kind of political views on. I thought that really struck me as quite powerful.
I think what we have to remember is that this wasn't just something the Nazis did. And I think this is one of the mistakes that scientists have made since the Second World War, is that everyone in the West, because we were on the winning side, was able to say that was nothing to do with us. Actually, it was all interconnected. Eugenics was developed, invented here in London. It was exported around the world. It became very popular in America. I mean, there were sterilization programs in America that continued into the 70s, in Japan, in so many countries around the world. And this was something that British eugenicists did. The fact that it went into Germany and there was this kind of exchange of ideas and ideologies that then this particular regime ran with, well, that's just circumstance, really. Yeah. It could have happened a different way.
It's funny, actually, because I was reading the book and then there was a street name that came up. And I was like, I recognise that street name. And it was 50 Gower Street, wasn't it? And I was like, that's where we record the podcast.
What? Shh. You want to get access to that
to retract that statement. I know that street because I buy biscuits.
I've never been there.
The point I'm trying to make is that it's way closer to home than you think. Yeah, and it's difficult to be introspective about these things, isn't it, sometimes?
And because scientists kind of in the West were able to wash their hands of everything, they felt that after the Second World War, whatever they did was fine because they weren't Nazi scientists, when in fact the same frameworks and the same language, everything really, to some extent, stayed intact. So even though there were efforts after the Second World War, and the UNESCO kind of spearheaded this, brought scientists and policymakers together and said, race is a social construct, it's a fallacy, let's move on. Well, actually, not all scientists were on board with that, including scientists at Oxford and Cambridge, were not on board with that. They weren't even on board with a statement, within that statement, that said, we are all one human species. Just think about that. After the Second World War, British scientists weren't even on the same page about the fact that we were the same species. And that continued for a long time. And I feel that's still the bedrock upon which research is still being done.
I think it's interesting as well that some of the researchers who actually described themselves as anti-racist were still using sort of slightly problematic language.
Yeah.
So as someone who's mixed race, this guy, you know, he was talking about mixed race children and literally used like the phrase, the beauty and vitality of hybrids. And it's like, that's not language an anti-racist uses. Also, where is my promised hybrid vitality?
Put it on Tinder. Everyone mixed here, put that on Tinder.
And it's like the framework is so ingrained in everything that even when people are trying to dismantle the structure, they're sort of still working within it.
Yeah. And I think that's why I think it's important to remember it's not just about good and bad guys. It's about systems and institutions. So the quote that you just read out was from an interview I did with Luigi Luca Cavalli-Sforza, who was one of the leading population geneticists. He kind of founded the field. And sadly, he died last year. I interviewed him just very shortly before that. And he used the word hybrid, and I was really shocked. But then again, I have to remember, here is a man, an avowed anti-racist. He debated William Shockley when he was at Stanford. He was kind of the poster child for anti-racism in science. And yet he was able to use language like this. And the reason for that is the same reason that James Watson is able to use the language that he did. Because in his generation, this was acceptable. This is how we thought about these things. This is how we thought about human difference. And we have to accept that the leap beyond that has not been made.
It's also when you take... Okay, so there's, like, scientists who are doing...
Have you guys heard of the Met Gang Matrix?
No, what is that?
I've heard of it, but I don't know anything more about it.
So the Met Gang Matrix is a database. And it's a database that's filled with people who the police think pose a risk. It was set up really after the London riots. And it was set up to combat organized crime, organized gangs, you know, war on gangs, all that shit. And that's a really important thing. No one's denying it. The issue that you have right now is that on this database of, I think, almost 4,000 people, or 3,500 to 4,000 people, almost 9 in 10 of those people are black or Asian or like minority ethnic. That's insane. So that's 89%.
That is crazy.
89% of the people are black, Asian, or minority ethnic.
Just so that I can get it in my head, how does that represent, like, the population? Like, well, how disproportionate? That's obviously disproportionate, right?
Yeah. So London as a whole, when you look at the 2011 census, is about 60% white. So that means, you know, we've got 40% of London being black, Asian, or ethnic minority. But now you've got a gangs matrix that is 89%.
That's so crazy.
89% BAME, so black, Asian, minority ethnic.
Right, so how do they justify this?
So what they've said is that they've got suspects on there who are involved in gang crime. Cool. But they've also got a lot of people who aren't criminals or don't really have criminal intent.
So how do they end up on there?
So what they have is sort of, it's like a prediction algorithm. And that sort of worries me because my PhD, it uses a lot of prediction algorithms. And I write a lot of prediction algorithms. So I know that prediction algorithms, very easy to get wrong. What Amnesty UK have said is that this gangs matrix and sort of scoring of people in a sort of Black Mirror-esque way of, you know, are they known criminals or could they potentially have gang affiliation based off of lots of data that they're pulling, is actually a breach of human rights. Again, I'm speaking in a lot of hypotheticals because not a lot of information is out there,
right,
on the gangs matrix.
Yeah.
Some MPs have lobbied for it, sort of saying, like, and they've got sort of stats on the breakdown of demographics. So that's how we know that there are 90% BAME on there. And like out of that sort of 90 or 89%, 78% of them are black. So yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So further freedom of information requests haven't like been super successful currently. What they're doing is they're predicting, and they're predicting based off of common factors that they found in the database. So they've got known criminals in the database. They can say, okay, well, based off of the common factors that we have, so that might be behavior, that might be where they've gone, that might be places they frequent, you know, all of these things. Like, that makes sense, right? Police work. If you're doing that, if I'm like, if I know there's a criminal gang, I know that they're here. I know that they're, you know, every second Sunday they'll be in this location. They sometimes, you know, will go back and forth between these two postcodes or whatever, in this type of car. That's good police work.
Yeah, sure, but like for known criminals,
for known criminals, makes sense. For one situation.
Yeah,
if you're like doing one case, cool. But what's a worry in this case is that they're applying sort of technology to this, big technology, so data prediction. And in some cases, Amnesty have found that officers have used social media information without a warrant.
Wow.
So they're scraping people's social media information and your digital profile and pulling that together with other information you have. So probably financial information, probably, you know, like police records, like all of these things.
And presumably, like, they get access to this, the social media on open profiles,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's like what we leave as evidence. A public profile. Okay.
So here's my big issue. My big issue is because, like, all those things come together and they allow you to find certain factors that might be predictors. So if you've got like social media, you can do things like visual data analysis. So you can say, okay, what pictures they posted up? You can analyze those. You can do audio data analysis, like say they link to music or whatever. Location, you can get geolocation. You can get like time and dates, and you can work out when people are active online, what's this? And you can work out the profile, the digital profile of a supposed gang criminal. And that you can do things like sentiment analysis, which is reading tweets or Facebook posts or Instagram posts for emotion. So that's like a positive or negative feeling. So you can be like, well, 75% of our known criminals on our gang's database expressed negative sentiment about the police. So that becomes a predictor. You can think about
that's
it.
That's so dangerous.
No, so think about it. So I'm being sort of semi-facetious with this, but like imagine a hypothetical breakdown where it's like, you've got a data set that they have of known criminals. Let's say they've got known criminals. From this, they've said, okay, well, 62% of these known criminals live within 2 miles of a certain postcode. 80% have been in police custody before the age of 16. 33% have shared anti-police or anti-government sentiment in social media in the last 12 months. 55% of them are fans of Dragon Ball Z. Or have liked Dragon Ball Z like Facebook page, or have linked to Dragon Ball Z memes or something. I'm being facetious with the last point, but I'm really not, because I know some people who are about that lifestyle who fucking love Dragon Ball Z. Like I've got people who I know from when I was very, very, very young who are now doing dumb things, who honestly, an hour long conversation about who would beat one another, Vegeta versus Goku, like really super into that, super nerdy. So what's happening is that parts of culture are becoming criminalized.
That's what I was going to say. So like they're literally taking like information about how a criminal, a group of criminals behave, and then making these kind of links.
Yes.
Just based on their behavior, and yes, then connecting that behavior to people who aren't involved in criminal stuff,
potentially,
right?
Because those people become false positives, because everyone gets a score on this matrix. So it can be zero, it can be much, much higher, like 100. 100 obviously would be like, this person is probably super criminal. I don't know the exact scoring because, again, information isn't being released on this. I'm just spitting a hypothetical. But what's really happening and what has been confirmed is that things like drill music are being sort of used as one of the predictors. So you start criminalizing things in the same way they criminalized grime, in the same way people in the past have criminalized rap, but right now they're able to do it using computational algorithms. Yeah, so that means that if someone like me who likes a certain artist listens to them, I could potentially be picked up and put on this gang matrix. I could be there with a really low score because I don't do all of the other behaviors.
Do you know what this is like? I'm thinking it's like they're going to turn this into some kind of like credit rating type system,
exactly,
aren't they?
Like Black Mirror, but because that's what's happening right now. So people get red flags and they're on this database. They're red flagged on the database. But we don't really know how this database could be used. So if it's shared between other government agencies, imagine going to try and get a student loan, trying to apply for university, trying to get a job, trying to rent, and you find out you're on a criminal database.
Yeah.
Or you don't find out. You know, you're just turned away and not given a reason.
Exactly. And all that comes from the fact that you have been predicted to be on this database. Why I've been predicted on this database? Because the database has been trained on a sample group that is very heavily black from London. Mm. So that means